this episode of The Cauldron, we have Dr. Sharon Blackie, award-winning writer, psychologist, and mythologist. Her highly acclaimed books, courses, lectures, and workshops are focused on the development of the mythic imagination and on the relevance of myth, fairy tales, and folk traditions to the personal, cultural, and environmental problems we face today. As well as writing 5 books of fiction and non-fiction, including the best-selling If Women Rose Rooted and her new book Haggitude, her writing has appeared in anthologies, collections, and in several international media outlets, among them The Guardian, The Irish Times, and The Eye. Her books have been translated into several languages, and she has been interviewed by the BBC, US Public Radio, and other broadcasters on her area of expertise. Her awards include the Roger Deakin Award and a Creative Scotland Writers Award. Sharon is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and has taught and lectured at several academic institutions, Jungian organisations, retreat centres, and cultural festivals around the world. Her TEDx talk on the mythic imagination is definitely worth a listen to. In this episode, we delve deep into the world of wise and influential women in native mythology and what this means for navigating perimenopause and elderhood. We ask Sharon what we can learn from the myths embedded in our cultures. We take a look at the profession of midwifery, as traditionally midwives were the older women, not mothers themselves or past the mothering stage. We talk about how it is this group of women that can be leading the change in the birth world, not necessarily leaving it to just the younger midwives to fight. We discuss the overarching patriarchal messages which purport that menopause is an illness to be fixed, cured, or masked, so we can continue to look like the young maidens. And we hear about the power of elderhood and what we can learn even if we are still in our mother years, or just coming into perimenopause. All this and so much more in this fascinating episode of The Cauldron. So go on, put the kettle on, or tie up your shoelaces, as you are in for a real treat. But just a sec, before we start on this epic episode, if you love the show and want more from Rachel and me, then head on over to our websites and check out all the courses, books, collectives a go-go. You'll find all the details and occasional discount deals on the old Instagram at The Midwives Cauldron, or, of course, in the show notes below. And if you really, really love the show, please consider 2 things: a single or a monthly donation over on Patreon, or even buy me a coffee. And remember, that review you leave on your podcast host really makes a difference in who listens in. Thank you for your support. We just love having you bubbling away with us. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Sharon, it is an utter treat to have you in the cauldron with us. We are both very excited and have been waiting eagerly to have you here with us. You have a fascinating working life through your connection with psychology, myths, fairy tales, and how this coexists with ecology and the ways of the land. Can you tell us and our audience a little bit about how you came to this work and about yourself, because we are so excited to have you in the cauldron and introduce you to them.
Oh, well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Yeah, I never intended it all to come together in the way that it did. It was just one of those midlife miracles that happens from time to time. So I trained originally actually as a psychologist and a neuroscientist, but had always worked with story in various ways ever since, you know, a small kid growing up on myths and fairy tales. And I suppose, to cut a long story short, it wasn't till I was around in my, I think, early to mid 40s when I had finally managed to give up the kind of corporate life, you know, which I didn't really thrive on, but which had been, I guess, keeping me safe for a number of years, that I began to bring those two together, because I went back to my original kind of calling of psychology and was practicing as a psychologist and began to work with story, because it seemed to me that the great thing about story is that it captures people's imagination and helps them to conceive of ways to change in a way that lots of psychological therapies can't. You know, literally, they help you to reimagine yourself. And so I started working with that. And, you know, it just turned into writing over the years as well.
That's fabulous. And thank you. I can't wait to get started. I'm like, oh, full of so many things. I came to your work through your book, If Women Rose Rooted, where you have drawn inspiration from wise and influential females in native mythology. And you've done this again with your book, your brand new book over the last few months called Hagitude. And the reason that Rachel and I wanted to bring you into the cauldron, even though it's called the Midwives Cauldron, is we had an overwhelming response to a previous podcast that we did right back in our first season that included talking about perimenopause and menopause with Jane Hardwick Collins. We thought it would be really great to get you in to have a look at this topic more. And I know I love the book, and I know Rachel loved the book as well.
Yes, I just want to say a huge thank you for that book. I read it just at the right time, and I absolutely loved it. And when I teach midwives and birth workers, this stuff comes up again and again, because so many of them are in the perimenopause, menopause age and are struggling with that. And, you know, then with giving to, you know, women who are birthing and trying to balance all of that. And, you know, I read your book. I just loved it. I just wanted to, I keep saying I need to go to the desert. I really need to go to the desert. I'm sure we'll get onto that later on. So thank you. And the book cover is fantastic as well.
Thank you so much. I think for me, I was growing tired, particularly in the context of Hagitude. I was growing very tired about all of the negative stories that are told about old women in our culture, and the way that we are encouraged predominantly to be invisible, you know, to just shut up and sit in a corner, because now that we're not fertile anymore, we have nothing to offer the world. And I really certainly was not seeing that as my own path forward by any stretch of the imagination. And as always, I turned to the stories for inspiration and really embarked on quite a big research project to go through a lot of European folklore to find out what the old women were actually doing in these tales. Because, as you know, the protagonists of most of the stories tend to be younger women, whether they're princesses or milkmaids or whatever they might be. The main focus of the stories tends to be on the young ones, but the old women are always there in the background. And what I was really interested in when I did that research project was to find out how many different kinds of old women there were, you know, that they weren't just all one type of old woman, that they had different gifts, they had different skills, they participated in the stories or they directed the stories in different ways. And it just seemed to me that putting all of this together and saying, look, you know, back in the day, our ancestors saw the possibilities for old women as rather different and perhaps a little bit richer than we do today. And as women are going into perimenopause and menopause and struggling to figure out what on earth this is all about and what they're going to become at the end of what is a really, really difficult process, I really just wanted to, you know, to offer up some possibilities. Again, that concept of different ways of reimagining ourselves as to the one, apart from the ones that the culture is trying to force upon us, which are no use to us or the culture at all.
Absolutely. Yeah, I loved it. And the whole silencing, and I that I think is a huge thing, is women feeling that they have no voice. And yet, particularly in relation to kind of the birth world, a lot needs to change. And I, you know, I think a lot of emphasis is put on, or the new graduate midwives, the, you know, the maidens and the mothers need to be changing it. When actually I really feel like those of us who are past that phase, need to be gathering our voices and speaking out and, you know, using some of that power that we have that we've been told we don't have.
Indeed. And I think, you know, one of my favorite characters in European folklore for a long, long time before I ever started to write Haggartute has been the character of the henwife, who is normally portrayed as a, I would say, probably menopausal kind of age. You know, she still has daughters at home often. I mean, marriageable age, but so she's someone who we might think of as kind of in the prime of life rather than in actual elderhood. But she is the keeper of what you might think of as women's mysteries. And so she talks to the young girls about their husbands and about marriage. And I see her also as falling into that midwife category, because you don't actually often find actual midwives in European myth and folklore, which is bizarre when you think about it, because clearly they played a major, major role in the community, but they don't often appear as certainly as speaking characters in the stories. And the henwife is kind of the closest that we get to it. And she's interesting because she always lives in the community, whereas a lot of the older women are solitary, you know, they live in the forest or whatever. But the henwife is often housed at the king's castle or in the middle of the village. And she clearly is a sort of wise woman. She does keep hens and she does sell eggs, but the heroines always go away with more than they bargained for. So I often think of the henwife as kind of a midwifey kind of character, you know, that same sense of, but she's birthing, she's not birthing babies, she's kind of birthing young women into their adult selves, I suppose, in a sense.
Oh, that's great. And that is kind of where the role of the midwife always was, as an apprentice that would be of the woman who was based in the community. And that's how we would have learnt our ways, and we would have eventually ended up ourselves being the henwife or the midwife in that scenario at that time of our life as well.
Indeed. And again, you know, if you look back, and you all, I'm sure, will know this much better than I do, but a woman in, I don't know, I mean, let's say even 300 years ago, who was a midwife was rarely just a midwife. When I say just, I don't mean merely. That wasn't her only job. You know, she was often a wise woman as well. She knew other kinds of healing. She knew how to work with herbs, and all of the things seemed to go together. And we do find a lot of wise woman characters in folklore who probably are midwives as well. It's just that they're not always in the stories for their midwifery. And they really do, in many of the old stories, hold the wisdom of the community. You know, they're the ones that people go to when they don't know where else to turn for advice, particularly when something in the community has gone drastically wrong. They were almost like, you know, community psychologists, as well as doing the practical healing stuff and the midwifing birth stuff. So a really interesting history, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. When we look at the myths in terms of what Rachel was speaking to, of the struggles that midwives are currently faced with in many Western, mostly Western hospital maternity services, you know, they're constantly in this fight mode of dealing with trying to protect the women and the families that they work for, fighting for better pay, fighting for better services, fighting to do no harm to their clients. And like Rachel said, that this fight seems to be coming from a lot of the younger midwives. But how can we draw strength from those tales of the older women? Are there any specific stories which could kind of use as a guiding light to show us that we do have that strength as we move into those elder years?
I think all of them do. You know, what I did in Haggartute was to look at a whole variety of different ways of being elder, what I called the House of Elders, you know, with many different rooms. And again, to stress that in these stories, there is no one way of using your voice. There is no one way of being strong and enduring as a woman going into menopause or as an elder woman. There are lots of different ways. And to me, it is important that everybody finds the particular story or the particular archetypal old woman that seems to speak to them. You know, so we have trickster characters who are disruptors of a community that needs to be disrupted. We have truth-telling characters who tell all of the heroes all of the ways in which they have completely messed everything up, and you know, they need to just like get on with it and make it go now. We have mentors of younger people, like the fairy godmothers, you know, who are actually powerful characters, not all Disney frills and froth back in the day. We have women who literally weave the world into being, who are maintaining the balance of the cosmos, creatrixes, if you like. We have women who are more about midwifing death, perhaps, than birth, the harbingers of death, the ones who kind of, you know, guide the soul onto its next journey into the afterlife, whatever that might be. And so I think that we can find stories that speak to everyone's individual and unique gift. So there's no one way of doing it. What I wanted to do is bring together all kinds of different ways of doing it to say, well, which one works for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And you did.
Yes.
I love the weaving of the stories, and they really spoke to me. And I love the names of the old chapters. And I wanted you to speak a little bit more about, because I think a lot of this is the retelling of the story. Because as you said, when we talk about perimenopause and menopause, it's often in this really negative way and really disempowering way. And your first chapter is The Alchemy of Menopause, The Fire and the Furies.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, you know, every woman that I have ever spoken to about menopause, literally every woman, I'm sure there are women who don't experience this, but I haven't come across them yet, talk about the primary kind of psychological effect of menopause as being rage, just absolute rage. And I think of that as having a function. It's just menopause undoes us in various ways, okay, not just physically, but psychologically. It's literally burning away everything that we thought once defined us and everything that we were kind of clinging on to. And I think what happens when you're going through this kind of loosening up process, when everything that you wanted to cling to, all of the structures are crumbling away, it shakes a lot of stuff loose, you know, bricks, mortar, all kinds of stuff comes loose. And I think women suddenly begin to be aware of all of the ways in which we have been, you know, not listened to, all of the ways in which we have been sexually abused or harassed, or all of the stuff that happens to women in the culture today. At menopause, you can't hold in the anger anymore because all of the foundations and the structures are crumbling, and it just comes out. And I think for a lot of us, I mean, certainly I wasn't rationally angry at all. I was just angry, you know, and that lasted for a while until I figured out, okay, this isn't very healthy just to be raging at anything that happens to come across you in the wrong way. But then I thought about alchemy and the transformation of that just sheer anger and rage into something that is more functional, which is the concept of wrath, you know, which has a kind of righteous element to it, which is that you channel that anger, you transform it, you channel it into something that is useful, in which you will tell the world all of the ways in which this is just not acceptable, sorry, but you do it in a way that is constructive rather than destructive. So there are lots of ways in which that idea of alchemy works for us, I think, in menopause. And it is very much, you know, the process of alchemy is about kind of purifying, for want of a better word, a particular substance, so that you strip away all of the dross and you strip away all of the stuff around it. And what you're left with is the absolute essence of the substance. What you know, and it raises that question, doesn't it, of what is left when everything that you thought defined you, all of the little contraptions and all of the kind of clothes and the, you know, the ways of being in the world when we were younger, all of that isn't available to you anymore. All of that is stripped away. What's left? And because I'll forget otherwise, in the context of rage, sorry, what I wanted to also point out is that in Greek mythology, there were three old women whose point was to be angry. They were supposed to be angry, and they were the Furies. And the Furies weren't just angry again for the sake of it. They were angry at specific things that were believed to be completely morally unacceptable in Greek society, like you didn't respect your elders. Those were good days. Or you might have killed your mother, or some, you know, from seemingly small to the very, very large. And they would then chase the evildoer and harangue them until they in some way repented or made it right. So again, there was a point to it. It wasn't just we're going to, you know, we're going to terrorize you just for the sheer hell of it. It was we are going to terrorize you until you understand that you've done something wrong here and you go about changing it. So that is a really good example of what I mean by the difference between just like, you know, rage for the sake of it and rage that is intended to have a function and to keep the society in balance, which is what the Furies actually did.
Yeah, that really spoke to me, actually. I feel like I am on that precipice at the moment of coming into this, and I feel the rage. I have to admit, I'm feeling the rage, and reading your words was just like a relief moment of being able to take that and focus it and know that this is an unraveling that's going to go and going to occur and happen. I'm going to be transformed and I need to go through this and to be able to sit in it as uncomfortable as it can be at times, but to know that that rage can be channeled in a different way than I've had in these sort of mother years of birthing projects, which it has been for me rather than birthing children. I really found those words supportive, helpful, and really powerful, actually. And so, yeah, it was constructive, and I needed to hear that as well. So I think our timing, or your timing of the book, feels so perfect for so many.
Well, I hope so, because it is interesting. It has landed at the beginning of, or in the middle of, an increase in the cultural conversations about menopause. But as fine as it is that we are talking more about menopause, I do find most of those conversations to be completely missing the point. You know, so many of them are still couched in medical terminology. You know, menopause is a kind of disorder. The symptoms of menopause, which we must ameliorate, you know, with HRT. I have nothing against HRT used properly, by the way, just to say that. But this medicalization of menopause is still continuing throughout those cultural conversations. And when it's not being medicalized, it is being presented as something we must hold off at all costs. How to stay young and beautiful through menopause and into old age. That's not what it's about. There's nothing wrong with that. Again, if you want to stay, you know, if you want to take care of yourself during menopause, and into elderhood, of course we want to, but to have that as the primary focus, where it's all about clinging on, you know, to everything that is naturally and inevitably going to slip away from us, seems to me to be missing the point. And I really did want to step in there with the idea that we have to really tell women, I think anyway, it's a purely personal opinion, that it's really going to be difficult at times, and that some things are supposed to be difficult, because without the difficult stuff, you don't get to transform. And that doesn't mean to say that I think that people have really serious physical symptoms, you know, that do need help and treatment should just, like, you know, cling onto the side of their chairs and hope it all turns out all right in the end. But it is supposed to be a difficult transition. And we live in a world where we want to smooth away everything that's difficult and just have everything to be nice and light. And it's not about that. And women who do recognize that, and to have been told about that this is how it is supposed to be, you know, it's really crap, but this is how it's supposed to be, women who've been told and educated about that find it very much easier to get through, because they know that there is a point to it, you know, that something on the other side is going to happen, which is actually quite magical. And we don't talk about that. We don't talk about that magic of elderhood and why we would actually want to allow some of this stuff to be stripped away from us, which is actually diverting, you know, from the good stuff.
Completely. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, but it's like any of the rites of passage that women go through, it's kind of the power of that darkness and the unraveling and the kind of challenges is taken away, and we're told to medicate it, or that it's not normal, that we need to not feel, not, you know, experience any of those difficult things, when actually it's in those difficult things that the transformation really happens. And, you know, that's just mirroring menarche and childbirth. And certainly in the, you know, I keep saying I'm menopausal and then I'll have a bleed, because that's how it works. I'm fine, 100 days. Oh, there you go. I can't say I'm menopausal. But talking about it in general to, you know, women who aren't maybe thinking too much about it, it's they if you say I'm menopausal, it's met with, oh, that's really awful, or don't talk about it. You know, I noticed at work when I would mention it, it would be like I was saying, you know, I'm taking cocaine tonight. You know, that was the kind of response I got when I tried to talk about it. And when we do talk about it, it's all about, yes, the symptoms and how we can get rid of the symptoms and how we're all now, you know, mental and can't think properly and forgetful. And like, you know, the other day, a woman actually said to me, someone was talking about aging. She said, oh, we don't use the word aging here. Shh. It's just fascinating that women can't go there. They can't see the gifts that we're going to get as we age.
And I think that the prime reason why it is seen as an aberration is that the culture is run by men who don't have it. You know, I mean, it's not clearly men have psychological changes at midlife. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. But it is not mirrored by the same kind of physical cataclysms that women go through during the kinds of transitions that you're talking about. And so they don't understand it. They're a little bit frightened of it because they haven't seen the point of it. And so they try to tamp it down. You know, they try to medicate us out of it. It was a group of men who first introduced HRT, you know, and gave it to women, not to help with serious physical symptoms that they might need a little bit of help with, but as a way of kind of, you know, clinging on to their youth and their, you know, their fertility and what have you. And I think we frighten them. And I think old women have always frightened the patriarchy, if I can put it that way, rather than say men specifically, because of course a lot of them are very, very supportive. Older women have always frightened the patriarchy precisely because those things that bind us to them have loosened. And we begin, so just as a, it seems like a diversion, but I promise it's relevant. So one of the reasons that I use the word hag in Hagitude, and that I am so fond of the word hag, apart from the fact that it spans quite a big chunk of life from midlife all the way through to the end, whereas crone, for example, is very much at the kind of croaking end of elderhood. One of the reasons I like the word hag is that hags in the old stories are the women who are not defined by their men. And they're not actually defined by their relationships to anybody. They're not someone's wife. They're not somebody's mother. They're not someone's friend or sister or whatever. They probably have those relationships, but that's not what the story is about. The story is about them and their gifts and their power and their insights and their wisdom. And I think it has probably always been so that as those chains that bind us to men because of the romantic stuff and the fertility stuff kind of begin to fade a little bit, that there's a sense that they're losing control over women, and that can't be done. Hence, you know, to some extent, it's a complicated area, but to some extent, hence the witch trials.
Yes. There was something that came up talking to this of magazine covers from famous actors or actresses, Jennifer Lopez and I think the other Jennifer Aniston. I'm great with names. And one's 51 and one is 53. And there was some commentary about them because they appeared on the cover of the magazine looking fit, six pack, showing legs, boobs, whatever, but really looking as this maiden typical image that we see. And the commentary, which is interesting, was what message is this sending? They were able to say, this is not reality. What are we now showing? That we all have to have a six pack at 53 and we all have to do this. And this is the only way we can go into elderhood is by looking like a superstar who has a nutritionist and a 7-hour workout every day. And I saw another advert recently from a man saying how he can fix the menopause and fix all the symptoms and fix your body. And it just feels like this narrative is constantly popping up. And it's a hard one to battle with because it is in our faces daily, everywhere we look.
But I do think, and you know, I'm not in any way anti-men. Just for clarity.
Oh, no.
But I am anti the patriarchy. And I do think it is because the narrative here is defined by men. So they want women to be attractive to them for as long and fertile for as long as they can keep us attractive and fertile. And I know that's an oversimplification, but just to, you know, just to point out the problem with that narrative. Whereas what is interesting is when I talk to women about images of old age, the images that they find absolutely beautiful are the ones of the very wizened old women, you know, wrinkled within an inch of their lives, but with beautiful, bright, shining eyes. And young women love that. And they want to be able to grow into that. And we need to provide stepping stones so that they can see a path to inhabit that story. And if we don't do something to help young women figure out that actually they do want to get old and look like that, as opposed to be clinging on to, you know, to for dear life, to their exercise bikes, then it's not going to go well for women, or I think actually for the culture, because the culture does need older women with wisdom and voices. So I think it is very interesting that what men see as, you know, as a positive image for womanhood in elderhood is often very different from what women want for themselves. They don't want that. It's exhausting. We've done that. You know, we've done that for the first half of our lives, which is all about the outer image, you know, what we are in the world, constructing stuff in the outer world, families, careers, images of ourselves and so on. What we want to do when we get older is turn inwards, and we want that light of wisdom and beauty, I think, shining out of our eyes, not our abs.
Yes, definitely. Shining out of our eyes, not our abs. I like that. It's too true. I mean, you just think of those, like I still have a memory of being a child and the helper in school. And I remember saying to her, your fingers are squishy because of the wrinkles and the lack of tone in her fingers. And I still remember that warmth and the light and kindness in her eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
40 years later. So there is that beautiful gentleness of grandmother figure, elder figure, that can be there, but it's taking that strength of, I think, going into this phase without this fear that we are bombarded by, because it does feel like a fear. It does feel like, gosh, how am I gonna feel when I lose X, Y, and Z, how I look, how my hair is, it's gonna change.
Yeah. And again, that's because we have been, I think those of us anyway, I mean, younger women perhaps don't feel the pressures the same way that I certainly do at 61, growing up in the 60s and the 70s, that it was all about men, you know, that you lived in order to be acceptable to men. And so women, I think, have kind of accrued that sense of what is acceptable to men is acceptable to us too. But as I say, I don't think that that actually is the case for women. I think they want to grow old and wrinkled together. But if we don't start challenging those images that are out there of, you know, 60-year-olds on exercise bikes as the epitome of being a good elder woman, if we don't start to replace them with our own, then nothing is going to change. And I do think it's really, really important that we start to talk about this more. And that's one of the reasons why I'm still very disappointed by a lot of the conversations around menopause. You know, I think Mariella Frostrup, for example, is absolutely wonderful and a really brilliant writer. And I loved her recent book about menopause, but she is still portraying an image of someone who is very beautiful and, you know, for whom that is a major focus. And I think I think when we go through menopause, you know, it is important to grieve the loss of things that have defined us. I think it's okay to mourn the loss of kind of, you know, youthful beauty and firm breasts and all of the rest of it and everything else. I mean, not just trivial things like that, but other things too. It is a period of grieving and mourning, but we have to be able to point to images that are inspiring for us when we've gotten over that, when we've transformed that grief into, you know, something where we're looking forward to a brighter future. So I think it's really important that we start to get these conversations out as a kind of antidote to all of the male-focused or patriarchy-focused conversations about elder women and associated images of them.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the Global Lactation Clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
But I think that's what you offered in your book was the archetypes and the role models. And I think, you know, for a lot of women in our culture, once all of that is stripped away and they've kind of gone through that fire and fury and they've stripped away the parts of them that they thought were them, there's often nothing, you know, if you're not sexually attractive anymore, if you're not a mother or mothering or in that kind of role, I think a lot of women feel very lost. I mean, that's the kind of, that's what I see is a lot of women my age seem really lost without those roles. And often we'll then go back into them either through, you know, trying to get back to the maiden sexual thing or mothering again, like, you know, grandmothering and focusing. That is their primary identity. You know, I think it's really difficult for women to look in and kind of go, right, well, who am I without all of that? What is it that I want? You know, what's for me now in this? And that's what I really liked about the archetypes and the stories you told. You know, I was reading and go, oh, yes, I can identify with that archetype. I can see that in me. But how do we get that into kind of mainstream so women have other role models?
I think only by becoming it ourselves. And, you know, it's a ground up thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, so people, I think, need to be able to find ways of reimagining themselves based on who they are at heart, based on who they have found out that they are after menopause has stripped all the other stuff away from them, and based upon what their gifts are. Because I think there are two prongs to this. There's yes, the sense of coming into a deeper sense of who we are us for ourselves, because we need to know that, because we need to grow into authentic whole human beings from whom the kind of what Jung called the persona has been stripped away a little bit. We need to know who we actually are rather than, you know, that have that based on the face that we have been taught to present to the world. And menopause strips away that persona. But it's also, so it's partly about that, so that we as individuals grow into authentic human beings, but it's also about the gifts that we give to a very challenged world. And, you know, that's important too. The one leads to the other in my perspective. And so I do believe that there are key roles lacking from contemporary Western culture, which Indigenous societies and indeed our own ancestral societies would have had. And these were the ones that we see old women fulfilling in the old stories. They're not just entertainment for kids. They are stories which reflected the social and cosmological perspectives of the day. And old women had functions, and we don't have those functions anymore, and we have to reclaim them. And nobody is going to give them to us. You know, nobody's going to say, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if we had old women who were really wise, you know, kind of talking about this and talking about, it's not going to happen. We have to claim them, I think, for ourselves, believe in them, gently allow ourselves to grow into them, and then become them and find ways of doing it. And it's tricky in a culture that doesn't really want you, except women want it. And bugger the others. You know, we want that. Young women want it. They're desperate for role models, not only that they can grow into themselves so they can see the point of life, of living for that long, but also because they need help. Because it's really difficult out there for young people, and they're not really getting it from anybody other than themselves.
I think that's absolutely true. I must say my group of friends have been saying to me, can you please talk about more stuff about perimenopause, about what's going to happen when we get older? That seems to be the general conversations that's been coming through for the last year. I think particularly since COVID, because a lot of people have had that opportunity in one way or that forced upon them to have to go inside, to have to be kind of trapped in a certain sense physically and in a psychological sense as well. And so that message is coming through to me of, goodness, I don't know the direction. I don't know what to expect. I don't know where to go. And I think when you talk about wrath, that's designed for us to have this kind of rage, but this focused rage, this wrath, for a reason, to be able to say, bugger what's going on outside. Bugger who's telling me that I have to fit in this box. I'm going to do it my way. And I think we need it. So also feeling that there is a purpose for this kind of this anger. But if we can find the way to focus it without sending ourselves slightly doolally, I think it feels like that's the message for me, to try and be able to focus this potential power, so to speak.
Yeah, it's really about finding what makes your heart sing, isn't it? And on the one hand, and also finding what you can't bear to lose on the other hand. And again, the two are often connected. And that, I think, is how most of us find our work in the world, when we really sit down and, it's not think about, because it's not an intellectual process, but when we really understand that that is how it works for us. But we're not taught very many useful life skills beyond the practical day-to-day. Do you know, we're not taught that we are supposed to grow and transform and change and be very different in one stage of our lives from what we were when we're younger. We're taught that in some way that is a little bit, doolally, as you say. You know, you've got to be the same person. You've got to be stable. And that's not how it's supposed to work. It doesn't happen that way in any of the old stories for a reason, because it's not supposed to. You're supposed to have these periods of intense challenge, the initiatory periods, the periods where you go down into the underworld and meet all kinds of frightening things, or you go into the enchanted forest and you're challenged by monsters and witches and all kinds of other characters that you'd really prefer you hadn't encountered. But that's how we grow. And as a psychologist, I can tell you absolutely categorically, there is no real growth, no real transformation without a lot of pain. And that's not to say we should all go out there looking for pain, but life is painful. And the only way through it, I think, the only way through any pain and difficulty, whether it's the pain of menopause or the pain of a divorce or a bereavement or anything else that happens to us, is to see it as an opportunity for alchemy, for transformation. What can you do with it? What can we make of this? And we're not taught to look at life like that.
And looking at it like that helps you through those times. If you can conceptualize it in that way, it's so much easier to deal with the, you know, the abyss, the darkness, knowing that it's part of the transformative process.
It is, yeah. And so at the end of Haggitude, you know, I write about it happened to so many people at the beginning of lockdown and in the midst of the pandemic and all of the nonsense and fear that was going on around that, I developed lymphoma. It was quite an aggressive form of lymphoma, but happily I had a really good hematology department and chemotherapy department who just made it go. And it's aggressive, but it's very treatable, which is very, very fine. But and nobody could understand why. Actually, I had a great deal of equilibrium about that. I didn't want to have an aggressive lymphoma. Mm. I'd much rather not have had it, but I had it and I couldn't make it go away myself. And so I really did, because that's the way that I am trained to think, okay, what is this teaching me? What am I going to make of this, whether I am alive at the end of the treatment or not alive at the end of the treatment? What am I going to make of it? What is it for? And I did. I really, and I'm not saying this to say I'm very wonderful. It's just that because I am taught, I've taught myself in a sense to look at the world this way. So I cancelled all of my appointments. I focused on writing Haggitude. That was the only thing I did. I didn't talk to anybody I didn't want to. I didn't do anything I didn't want to. I just allowed myself to sit in that quite dark place and see what was coming. And I can tell you wholeheartedly that it was a gift in the end. It's easy for me to say that because here I am alive and thriving, but it was a gift. And I think it would have been a gift no matter what happened, because it made me focus on and confront a lot of things that I probably needed to focus on and confront. And I came out of it quite different for however long that lasts. It's very fine. And that is not that I am somebody special who has the great wisdom to see it. It's that I am a psychologist who works with myth and story. And so when something like that happens, I can only see it as something that is transformative rather than something that is the end of everything. Do you see what I mean? And so if only others were kind of taught, and I do mean taught, you know, even at school, for heaven's sake, we have no sensible life skills that seems to be taught in schools these days. If we were taught that life is about this, it's about these cycles and these deep journeys into the underworld and then coming out with a gift of some kind, I think a lot of people, in spite of the continuing pain and challenges of life, would find it more meaningful, you know, and more joyful.
Absolutely.
Mm. Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. And it's like you talk about the shedding of the skin of the snake, and that you had found the snake skin. Mm. And that represents, specifically for me, and also because Rachel's in Queensland, I also lived in Queensland, there's a lot of skin pythons. Snake skins that you find. Pythons, big ones,
got one on my wall over there.
And it does, it is that reminder of that life is this cycle, and we do have to go into these places where we have to sit, and they can be incredibly unpleasant and uncomfortable and worrying, but they do bring with them something that you wouldn't have experienced if you weren't within them. And it is a cycle. And I think knowing and having that deep knowing that things are cyclical, the world is cyclical, the month is cyclical, we are cyclical as women, helps me navigate what is happening at the time and what I'm going through. But it's always a very good reminder to hear it from the people that are around you, and also books like yours, and now on the podcast. So, yeah,
indeed, and it, you know, it brings us, doesn't it, to that other point, which is that menopause is one conversation we don't seem to be very good at having in the culture. But if we think that's bad, look at death. You know, we can't talk about death in any intelligent way, it seems to me, in this culture. I mean, we can amongst our friends, but you know, as a kind of cultural conversation. I don't know. I don't mean just in the media, but, you know, outside of a small kind of intimate circle of friends, we just can't. And even then, not a lot of people can't. We can't have the conversation. And yet it's the inevitable end of all of our journeys. You know, it's not like an optional extra that we might do. It's going to happen. And if we cannot, it does very clearly seems to me that if we cannot in some way befriend death, I don't mean want it, you know, or hanker for it, but acknowledge it as an inevitable kind of character. I do think of death as a character, but that's just me. I'm a bit weird when it comes to stories and archetypes. Just, you know, it's something that accompanies us throughout our lives. If we can't come to grips with that, I don't really think it's possible to live fully and to live courageously. I don't mean bravely, get courageously with, you know, being able to take the dark with the light and the difficult with the easy. And I really wish we would have more of those conversations. And again, you know, if you look at the old stories, it was old women who were the midwives of death. Old women, the banshee in Irish, and very many others, this similar cognate character in Scotland and in Wales. These old women who were harbingers of death, the Ban Cinnte in the Irish tradition, who's the kind of the keening woman who would turn up at wakes, wasn't just there to provide, you know, weird musical accompaniment, or even necessarily to allow the catharsis of proper grieving, which we're not remotely good at, both of which are really important parts of awake. But she was seen as someone who, by the power of her music, literally sang the soul into the afterlife. She was kind of like a soul guide. She was literally a midwife of, you know, of that transition, a very different kind of transition. Yeah. And I love that about women, because we have the midwives who give birth right at the beginning. And then we have the Ban Cinnte, the keening women, who are also midwives who, you know, right at the end of a life also have that that role. And it's beautifully joined up in the old stories. And we've just forgotten it. You can't have one without the other. You should have, you should have women, you know, presiding over both passages, it seems to me.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, That was really powerful in the book as well. And it is a conversation of that midwifing into death and the importance of that. And I've heard it started to be talked about recently, very recently, and it really piqued my interest because I thought, how have I never really thought about this before the last few years? This makes perfect sense. We need that. And yeah, I think we need these conversations to start happening so that we start thinking about this in our friendship circles. We start opening up these conversations. It is a really important rite of passage as well.
Mm. I think there's a bit of a reclaiming of that, because traditionally, you know, wise women would have been the midwives and would have laid out the dead and midwifed the dying.
Yeah.
And I am seeing, you know, we're having death doulas. I spoke to a midwife recently who is going to move into midwifing the dying. She's a nurse as well. I think there's a kind of reclaiming almost of that role, because midwives have been, you know, put into this box of all we are doing is midwifing from a very medical perspective, basically nursing women while they go through the medical system of having babies removed from their bodies. That's kind of where we've been pushed into. And I think there's a shift and there's a reclaiming of our more full role, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have never given birth. I don't have children, so I'm not the person to talk about it. But I can imagine, as something that has always terrified me, the idea of it has terrified me for various reasons ever since I was a young child, that you would want, I'm sure you would want that sense of not someone who's just there to administer pain relief. And I know midwives aren't that, you know, I know they're much more than that to a lot of women, but to actually own that as a key function of the role, that sense of you need someone who you think of almost as a spiritual guide through what is a spiritual experience for most of the mothers that I speak to, whether they would accept that label or not, as well as a physical process of birthing a child into the world. And you want the two elements to be bound up, I think, when you're going through a really frightening process like that, whether it's giving birth or whether it's dying. You know, you need the comfort of the two. And so I love the idea of the doulas and of midwives accepting that old role, which is our lineage. That's the lineage of midwifery. It's not some new thing that we're inventing because we think it'll be fun. It's like how it used to be. And that's been taken away for this overly medicalized model of everything in our culture. So that's really lovely to know about and to see.
Mm. Yeah, before we go, I'd really like to talk about your other books, because I know we focused on Haggitude because I guess that's the one I'm most excited about at the moment. But can you tell us the other books you've written and what they're about, in because I know women are going to be listening to this and wanting more, so tell us more.
Yeah, I guess, well, my first book was actually a novel back in 1987 called The Long Delirious Burning Blue, which my husband calls The Long Delirious Burning Title, bless his heart. From that book onwards, from that first novel onwards, all the way through to Haggitude, and certainly the book that I'm going to be writing next, I would say that a key thread has been our relationship with place and how we develop a sense of belonging to the world. And I don't mean that just in the sense of what we might call nature connection. I mean it in terms of seeing the stories that come out of the land, that come out of our places, that are associated with our places, that are in our ancestry, that are in our lineage. Because I think, to me, belonging to the world doesn't mean just belonging to a place that you love, but it also means belonging to a kind of sense of continuity and a sense of enchantment or magic that's imbued in that place. So I suppose all of my work has those threads. It's very much about place, and it's very much about the stories and mythology of place, whether it is fiction or whether it's non-fiction. And even in that early novel, I was very much talking about the impact of the landscape and how it reflects psychological processes. But I suppose the book that most people would know best, because it has become one of those wonderful and miraculous word-of-mouth bestsellers, is If Women Rose Rooted, which was my first non-fiction book. And Haggitude is kind of a continuation of that, you could argue, in that I was really very focused on all of the old stories again, particularly in the Celtic tradition, but it's also true in England and other parts of Europe. And of course, England would have been a Celtic nation back in the day, pre-Anglo-Saxon. And that's important to understand. But in all of those old traditions, the stories show women not just as kind of a little bit like the fates were in Greek mythology, as kind of representing the sort of moral continuity and stability and balance of the universe. Literally, it was women's job to keep the world going, to understand the patterns that were necessary to keep it all literally functioning. That's what the fates did. They didn't just weave the world into being. They kept it all in balance. And if somebody took too much or something that wasn't theirs to take, they would have to step in and correct it. Otherwise, everything would literally go to hell in a handbasket. And we see that very much in our own native traditions as well. And also we see women very clearly as representing the land in a way that gave them kind of guardianship and a kind of protectorship over the land. So they weren't just like representations literally imminent in the land. They had the job of guarding it and protecting it. So you see wonderful characters like the Cailleach, which literally means old woman, Irish and Scottish Gaelic, who not only made, created and shaped the land and made all of the hills and mountains and valleys to her perfect design, but actually stopped humans from taking too much when it came to the wild animals. You know, you mustn't overhunt, for example. So we have all of the, so I realized that we had all of these wonderful examples in our old traditions of women having this great power. And it's not about power over, it's about power to kind of influence. Mm. And where had it all gone? You know, in the world today, you don't see any signs of that. You don't see anybody even knowing those stories. If we do know them, we tend to think of them as fairy tales, as entertainment for kids, not something that back in the day, actually, if you don't mind, represented an entire cosmology. That was our worldview. That was our religion. And so I really wanted to make women aware of those old stories and the fact that, you know, that in those times, we did have this really important function, because in a world that is, you know, on the verge of, if not already well into, environmental catastrophe, we need women who are strong to stand up for the planet as well as for ourselves. So if Women Rose Rooted was very much about, if we reclaimed those old stories and saw ourselves again as kind of, you know, the guardians and protectors of the natural world, as people who understood what was necessary to keep it in balance, as people who had that moral authority that was given from the other world, then boy, we could do some stuff. So if Women Rose Rooted really, I suppose, was kind of seminal in my own thinking. And then I wrote The Enchanted Life to follow up on some of those ideas and say, okay, how can you do that practically? How can you re-enchant your relationship with the world? And the other book is Foxfire Wolfskin and Other Stories of Shapeshifting Women, which is very much again about that sense of women's embodied relationship to the world, it's kind of reimagining of old fairy tales so that they're a little bit less patriarchal in their nature. They have a few more consequences, if you like. So yeah, all of the books are pretty much about the same thing. Old stories of women that give us lots of inspiration for ways of being, and all of it related to a really important embodied relationship with the world around us, whether that be animals and other than humans or whether it be the land.
Wonderful. Sharon, I just want to say thank you for your work, because it is so meaningful. Yeah. It is something that sits with me. I do love having your books there. I dip into them as well. And I think our listeners now have a huge reading list if they haven't already found your work, because I would highly recommend it. And it's, we could just do a whole podcast all day, but I am going to let you out of the cauldron. But with huge thanks for being with us and sharing your wisdom through your work and your words and being here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a really interesting conversation that's taken us to places I don't often get to talk about in podcasts. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
I hope you found a few golden nuggety nuggets in the show today. Please don't press pause, but instead scroll on down on your podcast app. Yep, that's it, down there, and pop a review and maybe a few stars to make our eyes twinkle with glee. For more on breastfeeding and lactation content, head on over to my website where my course is. And for courses and books from Rachel, you can find everything in the links below.
So all I got to say now is, see you next time. And I can't wait. So here's the bloopers.
Rachel, can you put that in the question? And go.
You're better at questions than me, Kate.
No,
you put in a question.
Not at all. Go on.
Well, hang on. I've just got a dog in here now with a squeaky toy. Can you hear her?
No, not at all. But I don't have my headphones on. It's only in editing I'll go, oh, for God's sake.
You'll probably hear her in editing.
Oh, now I can hear it, yeah.
So I guess before we...
It's fine. People are used to the dog and all
life.
The animals.
Okay. Life intrudes. It's great.
It's normal in this cauldron.
We take a look at the profession of midwifery. As traditionally. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and lactation, the fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's POD10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.